And one of the parts, so we talked last week with Bill Wynn from the executive director here of Edmund Hill County's Cooperative Extension about some of the teams that work behind the scenes as far as the public goes, but work more with the industry and the farmers. And from the vegetable team, we have Steve Reiners, professor at Cornell at the Geneva Experimental Station. And Steve, give us a little bit of idea of what you have here today. It looks like do you know your pumpkin test?
Yes, we do have that. I do a lot of work with pumpkins, so we've got a little test up there with questions, seeing if people are aware, first of all, New York Rose, we're usually number one, two, or three in terms of production in the country in jack-o'-lantern-type pumpkins. So we've got questions out there asking about some famous quotes about pumpkins. We've got questions about whether there's male or female plants or male or female flowers. What's the most important insect that you need for pumpkins, or we wouldn't have any pumpkins, and all those sorts of fun things.
Last year I discovered a pumpkin is a special variety, I guess, that has a stem that's about 5 inches across. And I think it was called a big stem pumpkin, something like that. And great flavor for making, like, soup with it and stuff. But it was just huge. And like with other vegetables, people are starting to think more about the different varieties, you know, and like tomatoes. Go to the grocery store, there's big ones, there's little ones, or there's tiny ones. But there's actually, like 5,000 varieties of them.
Right, there's many thousands of tomato varieties. And, you know, with apples, we're always used to seeing varieties. But with tomatoes, as you said, you go to the store and you don't really see that. But we've got some tomatoes here that we've got from our trial down in Penyan that are grown in a greenhouse. And we have about 11 different varieties of tomatoes that people can come out today and try. And they're listed by the variety here so they can get an idea. And it's probably not something they're going to be able to ask for at their supermarket, but if they're going to a local farmer's market, certainly the grower there could tell them, you know, what they've got and what they're growing.
We're lucky. I think here in Rochester we have a couple growers that between the two of them probably have about 150 varieties of tomatoes in the spring. You can buy the plants, which is pretty challenging to figure out which ones you want to grow. And for the farmers, too, I imagine, trying to figure out, it's almost too much of a good thing, you know, what should I grow and what's going to be in demand as well.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true, and that's one of the things we try to do for commercial growers is do trials in the field and look at lots of different varieties that are coming out to see whether there's something that's going to be, you know, really good in upstate New York. And something that grows well in upstate New York may not grow that well in southern Pennsylvania or in Michigan. Or certainly North Carolina or Florida. So it's very specific, and that's one of the things we've tried to do is to see what grows best. And for gardeners, it's the same thing. A lot of times they'll talk to their neighbors, they'll talk to other master gardeners and try to find out what's growing the best here in this area and then try that. And it's always experimenting and seeing what does best in your own garden.
Now, what's your background? Now, how long have you been at the experiment station, and kind of when did you get interested in agriculture in general?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey in the suburbs. It wasn't from a farming background at all. And actually, the first thing I ever planted when I was like 4 years old was a pumpkin. And I realized, so it's kind of funny today, all these years later, here I am with showing pumpkins and still growing pumpkins in my trials. So again, grew up in New Jersey, and I've been here at Cornell since 1994 over in Geneva at the experiment station.
And what do you specialize in there? Particular vegetables or pests or certain areas?
Yeah, I work with vegetable crops, and I'm not working with diseases or insects. You know, that's in pathology and entomology, so I've got colleagues that are doing that. So what I work with is looking at the best varieties and looking at the best ways to grow it. What's the type of fertilizer to use? What are ways that we can grow it to have the least amount of inputs? I mean, as we go more towards an organic-type situation. So it's really a lot of fun because I can grow, it's probably anywhere from 15 to 20 different vegetables in my trials every year. So it's challenging but fun.
And the Geneva Experimental Station is fairly, it's unique in the region, but around the country there are not too many places like it either. I mean, we're kind of lucky in the Finger Lakes to have Cornell here and the Experimental Station.
Right, and that's true. We just celebrated our 125th anniversary there at the Experiment Station in Geneva a couple of years ago. So we've been around for a long time. Of course, we're part of Cornell University. And it really works out well. We have about 750 acres there that we've got trials on. We do a lot, of course, with apples and grapes, wine grapes especially. But it's a wonderful place to work, and we have open houses very often. People may be interested to keep an eye on that and see if they want to come out and take a look at things out there and see all the different things we've got going on there.
It's generally not open to the public except for periodic open houses a couple times a year.
Right. It's typically not open to the public because we've got a lot of research going on there, and we can't just have people coming in and out. But
they'd be just picking all the fruit and vegetables and eating them.
That's what we're afraid of. And yeah, you go out and you put out a trial, and all of a sudden everything's been gone through. And so what we do is after we get our data, we'll just open it up to the people at the station, and there's about 300 people there total that work there, and we can get a lot out that way. And then if we still have some more, we can get some of that produce out to some of the local food banks too.
What about the groundhogs, though? They must be looking forward to your trout.
Yes, groundhogs, raccoons, deer. We've got them pretty well under control because everything's surrounded by a high deer fence. But it can be a challenge sometimes when we can lose trials to animals.
We talked a little bit last week with Bill Wynn from Cooperative Extension about his executive director here in Monroe County about broccoli being some work being done to try to get broccoli as an East Coast crop on a commercial scale, not homeowners growing it in their backyard, but really on a commercial scale because so much of it is grown on the West Coast and has to be shipped here, right?
Right. Yeah, probably the great majority of broccoli is grown in the West Coast, and they can produce it year-round out there. So for us, sometimes it's a challenge. Our summers can get very hot, and broccoli doesn't do well if it's very, very warm. But what my colleague who's putting this program together, Thomas Bjorkman at Geneva, is doing is trying to find varieties that can grow in the heat, the temperatures that we've got, and then really putting together an entire network across the East Coast that can produce broccoli year-round. And that's what buyers, supermarket buyers, really want to see. They want to be able to get broccoli from one source year-round. They can do that in California now, but we're hoping is that from Maine down to Florida, we'll be able to produce enough broccoli that we could meet the entire needs of the eastern U.S. by what's grown over here.
So in that case, it's more of a commodity scale, and again, Cornell's working with those farmers to try to figure out how to do it, and this was a good test summer for heat. It was a pretty good extreme heat.
This was an extremely warm summer, as I'm sure everybody will attest to, and we did get some varieties of broccoli that looked beautiful, which was just amazing. So I think we've got some potential varieties that will do great here, even in the summer heat.
That means jobs for farmers, maybe higher income crops than they might be otherwise planting?
Right. It's good news for farmers because it's going to give them another crop that they can grow. And if we can get this whole network together, I mean, that's really going to be effective because then they become a major force in the broccoli market. It's good for the consumer because it's going to be more locally grown. And then it's better for the environment in that you're not shipping in broccoli 3,000 miles. You might be shipping it in 30 miles or less.
And maybe a model for some other vegetables and things of distribution. Broccoli is maybe the leader and the first one that you work that, but that same network could be used or something similar for other vegetables.
It certainly could be. And then on a smaller scale, we're seeing, and Monroe County, I think, is a real leader in this area. We're seeing more being produced for winter storage and fall storage of vegetable crops. Crops sometimes that people haven't grown for years, celeriac, parsnips, turnips, things like that. We're seeing kohlrabi is another one that, you know, these are crops that can be stored. The old idea of a root cellar, you know, where you're putting something in a cool, moist environment. We can take these, we can put them in there, we can take them out. We have winter markets now here in Rochester, which we didn't have a few years ago. And again, keeping the money in the local community, it's going to the local farmers, and that's a win-win situation.
And they're good for you. A lot of those things are really good for you. In fact, the auditorium we're in now will have the winter farmers market in it. From basically November through May. And when they first did a winter's market, probably 4 years ago, it was sort of a last minute. It was like the end of October, and the farmers said, you know, we still have some stuff. Let's do a winter farmer's market. But they didn't have enough to satisfy the demand. And now they've had a couple years to research what to plant, when to plant, how to store it. And again, having Cornell, an experiment station close by as a resource, is crucial for that success and and the experimentation that farmers are doing.
And I think that's the real key, is because a lot of the work that's being done out here for growers and farmers is being done by this vegetable team, and that's an extension team. And they've got offices in Canandaigua, Niagara County, down in Penyan as well. And they're the ones that are working and doing those trials with the local growers. And Robert Haddad, who's on that team, was really instrumental in helping get the winter markets going here in Monroe County.
What's that huge cucumber you have over there?
That huge cucumber is really there to get people's attention. It's a plastic cucumber that, when I came here in 1994, I found it in the barn, and I've just sort of kept it around for occasions like this. And it's about 3.5 feet tall, I think.
Well, it's lighter than the giant pumpkins. You could bring in what was the biggest giant pumpkin you've run into in your travels around New York State?
Personally, I think the biggest one I've ever seen around New York has been about 400 pounds. But New York did have the record breaker a few years ago, which was about 1,200 pounds. Now Wisconsin has the record pumpkin, which is over 1,800 pounds. And it's probably just a matter of time before we reach the one-ton pumpkin.
That's you have a forklift to bring that in here to show people. Pumpkins do come earlier. And you think of pumpkins for Halloween, but there'll be pumpkins another few weeks, really, on some of the first pumpkins, and great pie pumpkins, and fabulous for eating and storing and cooking with.
Well, that's true. In fact, we're seeing pumpkins now with the heat that we've had this summer. It's really ripening them up, and we've got pumpkins now coming in at the end of August. The crop in this part of the state looks beautiful. Unfortunately, with what happened last weekend with Hurricane Irene, eastern New York has taken a terrible hit, and they may lose their entire pumpkin crop. But what we've got out here, I think, is just going to be one of the best crops that I've seen in 15 years.
It seems like for the sustainability of farming and agriculture in New York State, that one of our strengths is the diversity of what we can grow, fruit and vegetables, and kind of a sweet spot of both, where it's just warm enough for a lot of them and just cold enough for others. And if you're growing a diversity of things, then you're hedging your bets against Mother Nature, really.
Right, that's true. I mean, if you've got 2,000 acres planted to one commodity and then something comes along, whether it's a disease or a problem with the weather, you lose everything. Here where you're starting to harvest, you might be harvesting asparagus in late May, and you're doing pumpkins or maybe even winter crops well into the fall. It does allow you to diversify, so you're not putting all your eggs in one basket and having a potential problem.
Now, you mentioned earlier the most important insect for a pumpkin, which is no doubt a honeybee to pollinate it. I'll take a wild guess. But do you also get involved with honeybees in trying to bring them into farms and for pollination? And one farm I heard, Orchards, had to bring in bumblebees from Michigan because the honeybees didn't want to work in the rain in May, in the cold.
Well, it's interesting. We have an entomologist colleague of mine at the station, Brian Dalton. He's actually looking at which bees are visiting the flowers, which are doing most of the pollination work in pumpkins. And what he's finding is that, of course, the native honeybee has had a lot of problems over the past 10 years, and the population is declining. The number of hives that are available for people to rent is also declining. It's not that there aren't as many hives as there were. So people are looking at alternatives, and bumblebees, as you say, is one that we're seeing people actually putting some bumblebee hives out into the field. And what he has found is that the bumblebees, and probably because of their size, they're much bigger than a typical bee. When they go into a flower, they get really covered in pollen. And then when they go from the male flower over to the female flower, they move that pollen off. So, for example, it may take maybe 12 or 15 visits of a honeybee, a smaller honeybee, to a female flower to get enough pollen in there to get fruit set to occur. But the bigger bumblebee might only take 3 or 5 visits of that bumblebee. And, yes, they actually went out into the field at 6 o'clock in the morning and looked at all of that.
Yeah, I can just see them, sort of like traffic. I never knew there were traffic engineers, people who, count cars at intersections, literally counting them. And now they have machines that do that, but they still do some manually because machines don't deal with turns and other traffic things. So I'm picturing these researchers sitting in a chair next to the flowers, counting the bees. I mean, there's really no other way around that to figure out how many visits. Right?
Yeah, that's true. They'll just sit out there in a chair or a bucket. They've got
a job for an intern.
Well, yeah, we have a lot of summer. We do hire a lot of summer students over there in Geneva, and they'll do that. And they have to be out there early because the bees are going to do most of the flying and pollinating from maybe as soon as the sun comes up. They're going to start to be active, and then once it starts getting warmer around 10 o'clock, they're going to disappear.
Hey, I find this use of bumblebees kind of fascinating because they live singly in the ground, as far as I know, and they don't have hives per se. So how do you create a hive of bumblebees? Seems like herding cats or something. That's not how they live. I mean, honeybees live all together, and bumblebees don't, at least the varieties that I'm familiar with. So I've got to see what these hives look like at some point. But again, that's part of the local economy. Buying local honey supports the local beekeepers who are supporting the local vegetable farmers and fruit farmers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's true. It's sort of a big circle here. So, when you're buying something that's produced locally, you're doing so much for. I mean, you're doing a lot for the industry here. The farmer that's growing there, keeping that land in farming in agriculture. And you think about, if you can buy something local as compared to buying something that might have been grown in another continent. It could be grown in South America, the southern tip of South America, and brought in. And we're used to having product, when we want it all year round. But then you think about the expense of bringing that in, it's huge. So when we can start thinking about buying locally, it makes a big difference.
What's your favorite vegetable to eat this time of the year? Are you particularly excited about any particular vegetable or fruit that is coming in the season?
I guess this time of year, sweet corn and tomatoes would be my favorite. And we've had, the heat has certainly been made things tough this year. But we have some of the best tasting produce this year because we've had so much sunshine. If a grower was able to irrigate when they needed, and most fresh market vegetable growers can do that, so they've been putting on the water as needed. They're controlling the water. We have incredible tasting produce this year, and I urge anybody, if they haven't tried a locally grown melon this year, to get one, because it's going to be, to make sure you're sitting down when you eat it, because it's going to be that good.
I was telling Walt Nelson earlier that you got to try ground pepper on cantaloupe. Very bizarre idea, but surprisingly good. Not a lot. I wouldn't do the whole cantaloupe that way, but a little piece just to try it out. Well, Steve, thanks for coming today, and you'll be here till 2, answering questions about pumpkins and vegetables in general. And it is not too late to plant. You can put in radishes and peas and spinach seeds right now, and of course garlic in another few weeks.
That's right. All the leafy crops can actually still go in. Swiss chard, lettuce, you can still put in, as you said, spinach, radishes, and garlic in a few weeks. So again, there's still a lot of growing season left.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's Steve Reiners from Cornell Cooperative Extension, from Geneva Experimental Station, and a part of the vegetable team.